National distribution of Smart City is made possible by the listeners of WKNO in Memphis and by the Hyde Family Foundation, investing in enlightened leadership, transforming the future of children and community.
I'm Carol Coletta, and this is Smart City. Two of the most vexing problems cities face are how to improve their schools and how to improve family incomes for those at the bottom of the economic ladder. Our guests today are probing those issues and finding some promising directions. Elliot Washer is co-founder of the Big Picture Company, which now operates 23 schools around the nation that build personalized education programs unique for each student with a heavy dose of real-world experience. Matt Fellows is a senior research associate at Brookings who investigated prices in Philadelphia's inner city and concluded that poor people are paying way too much for goods and services, which helps keep them poor. We'll talk about new approaches to improving schools and family circumstances today on Smart Cities. But first, the news. I'm Carol Coletta, and you're listening to Smart City. With Dennis Litke, Elliot Washer co-founded and co-directs the Big Picture Company. He also co-founded the Met Center in Providence, Rhode Island. He's been involved in school reform for more than 20 years as a teacher, administrator, and video producer. Elliot has taught all grades, from kindergarten through college, in urban and rural settings across all disciplines. He served as a consultant to schools throughout the U.S. and Europe. At Thayer High School, his professional development programs won an Innovations in State and Local Government Award from the Ford Foundation and the Kennedy School of Government at Harvard. What makes Big Picture schools different from other schools?
Well, there's a variety of things that makes us different. What we do is we change the formula, flipped education on its head. So instead of starting with classes for students to develop their interests, and maybe they find them and maybe they don't, we start with each and every student's interests. And then they get motivated to take classes. So we do one student at a time in a community of learners. We have small schools of 130 students apiece, no bigger. That also makes us different. So instead of doing large schools, we do systems of small schools. In Providence, we have six small schools, and they make up the Met, 130 students apiece. That's 720 students. Another difference is the level of engagement of families. Every student has a learning plan, and parents are at learning plan meetings four times a year. They're also involved in portfolio assessment of their students and in the exhibitions that their students do. Twice a week, our students are outside of school, pursuing their interests around something we call learning through interests or learning through internships, where students connect to adults who have similar interests, who know how to do things well. So through real-world learning, through developing rigorous academic performance, through real-world learning and personal relationships, and having our smallness and the structures that we have, we look real, real different than other schools.
Your 130 students in a school, they're spread over how many ages or grade levels?
Well, in our schools, the number remains about constant at 130, maybe 140, and that could be a K to 5 school or a 6 to 8 school or a 9 through 12 school, because when you get beyond that number, people don't know that many people well enough in their group. You start passing memos. So you stop operating under one set of rules and start operating under another set of rules. So it's like the difference between how people know one another in a city and how people know each other in a town. So we have K to 5 schools. We have 6 to 8 schools, 9, but mostly we have high schools.
Now, you say that you begin with a student's interest, and then you take those interests into classes. How do you discover a student's interest?
Well, data in psychology and in education supports what we're doing, in the sense that if you read autobiography or if you study people, by the time students or children are 3 to 5 years old, they already have identified numerous interests and have connected themselves to adults around those interests. And what we're doing is we're basically taking advantage of the real natural ways that people engage and how they learn. Naturally, adults are teaching younger children at play around their interests. In graduate schools or in businesses, or sometimes in high schools, as we have in other places, and learning that occurs in the real world outside of school, students and children connect themselves to adults who are in one-on-one relationships or very, very small groups in pursuit of what they're basically interested in. And those interests always lead to other interests, and those interests also can lead to academic pursuits. So that's why it's important to connect students to serious adult relationships around their interests.
I'm sure that many people hear you say, and students are out of school twice a week in real-world learning situations, and they must be thinking, oh my gosh, how are you keeping up with these kids? Are you just turning them loose on the city? How do you account for them? How do you account for them?
Right. Well, A, our students do shadow days at places before they take on their LTIs, their learning through internships or interests. B, they make phone connections before that to places that they may think are interesting to them. C, our teachers who are advisors on Tuesdays and Thursdays spend their days going to these places and sitting down with students and mentors and develop projects of a real-world nature where students can then blend in and integrate all their academics into the projects. And so these projects have a real-world context, but they're also engaged in the next level of their needs in academics. And so our academics are not called English, math, science, and social studies. Ours are called communication, empirical reasoning, social reasoning, and quantitative reasoning, and personal qualities, because everything we do has an ethical component. In other words, how do you know you're doing something well? And what does it mean to do something well, and how long does it take to do something well? Are questions that are constantly asked by students and advisors. And what does it mean to be smart in a given situation? Now, when you're just purely academic, you can be theoretical and play with stuff, and it can be very, very relevant. And that's fine for us. But when something is academic, it has this other negative connotation to it where it doesn't matter. And what we want students to do is to have things and do things that matter deeply to them.
I presume, Elliot, you don't pay the mentors or the people with whom students are engaged in the real world.
Right. When we started the school in Providence, people told us we wouldn't be able to get 50 mentors for our first students. We've had close to 2,000 now. We haven't paid any of them. What we've done is we've connected our way of doing things with how people are really wired. Once again, the adult-student relationship is very, very strong in everything that we do, including in business, including in college and university research settings, including in any kind of trade work. There's always been this bringing along and showing the ropes of younger people by older people. And it's a situation that in schools we don't take advantage of because we've organized learning, in quotes in some ways, in class situations of 20 to upwards of over 30 students who are there and may or may not want to learn at that particular time what is being taught. And therefore you end up with a situation where a lot is not learned. When you are in these one-on-one situations, all of a sudden lots and lots of learning occurs. And getting back to the mentor piece, mentors are willing to do this. Adults in the community are willing to do this because they've also realized that that's how really they were taught. A lot of people in schools sometimes go through the motions and game the system, and a lot of times schools are really, really good for certain kids, but there's a lot of kids they're not really good for.
Mm-hmm.
They don't learn that way. A lot of students have to be able to do something in order to know it, rather than just knowing it and then being able to apply it. A lot of times in the context, they can't do anything with the knowledge that they have. So we always feel that knowledge is not necessarily power, but the use of knowledge is power. And that's what you get when mentors are involved with students, and that's what mentors get out of the situation. They get this really, really good feeling that they're finally passing along what they know.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Elliot Washer. He co-founded and co-directs the Big Picture Company with Dennis Litke, and he's co-founder of the Metz Center in Providence. How many schools now operate as Big Picture schools, Elliot?
There are about 28 schools around the country. So we have schools in San Diego, Oakland, and Sacramento, Denver, near Seattle, Detroit, Indianapolis, Chicago, soon Cincinnati, Providence, Camden, New Jersey.
Do they all function as public schools?
Yeah, our mission is around public education.
Are they charters or optional schools, or are students ever assigned to your school?
Well, half of them are charters and half are district schools. And of the charters, many are schools that are chartered to the district.
Part of your philosophy is that parent engagement in a child's learning is essential, and big picture schools enroll families as well as students in the entire life of the school. Many public school teachers in urban districts would say, well, that's great if you can get families involved, but we can't. How do you do it?
Well, we do it, and we do it because we, once again, created the lowest common denominator of school, not as a class, but as a student. And parents will come if they're invited and your school environment is such that you're letting the outside in and the inside out. That's a whole other piece about what our schools look like. The average parent in our schools hasn't been to schools really before and hasn't been used as a resource. I can go in at a learning plan meeting and say, well, what did your son or daughter do when they were 3 years old? Did they like to play in a group? Did they like to play alone? What were the things that they liked to play with? Those give you indications about what their interests are. So there's an inviting atmosphere because, A, we're using them as a resource. B, the schools are small enough so they don't feel intimidated by a school. C, they have an advisor who is their child's student's teacher for 4 years, so they get to know them and the family real, real well. They come in 4 times a year to conduct learning plan meetings or exhibitions. So we are highly, highly personalized and engaged in meeting the needs of each and every student and family. When you do things like that, the word gets out. And when the word gets out, the parents start taking advantage of that situation. So if you focus it around the learning of each and every student, you get something real, real different than if you say, okay, come on in here as a class. And here as a parent night, and your teacher is talking to 20 or 30 or 50 parents, well, they want to hear about their kid. They don't want to hear about a curriculum. They want to know that their child is known well by an adult in that building. So they get a different sense of safety. They get a different sense of understanding of caring and who this advisor, this teacher knows, how well they know their son or daughter. All of a sudden, you're giving out phone numbers. You can be contacted as a teacher advisor. You don't have 130 students. I mean, I don't know how you can know 130 students, but you can know 15 to 17 students and their families and their mentors very, very well. And that's why those numbers are very, very important. And the organization about how really to organize school in a very, very different way. So learning is up front. So each and every student is up front, and the curriculum is built around each and every student. All of a sudden, parents respond to that.
Your critics say that the big picture model is irrelevant to urban school reform, that it can serve a few students, but that it is not scalable. How do you respond?
Well, scale is a funny word. We had in this country hundreds of thousands of small schools and small school districts. If you read the data and the studies, they were fairly successful at what they did. It was the notion of a comprehensive high school by James Conant that changed how we think about comprehensive high schools, offering more classes around students' interests, and to get to some type of economy of scale around school, and to get to certifying teachers. Now, those are real important things, but Conant's high school that he designed as a large, large comprehensive high school was no more than 500 students. The Met at this time is 720 students, 6 small schools. It's how you organize your school. It's how you scale. It took 50 years to change how we went from small schools to large schools. It'll take another 50 years to get back to doing things in a way that is more highly personalized for some of our students. I would say 50% of our students are not learning because of the environment that they're in. These large regional high schools are not meeting their needs and could if they focused on the students and their learning in different ways. But they're alienating. They have high security. You feel like you're not being trusted because there's cameras all over the place, there's security all over the place, and now you're talking about a level of economy of scale that is not directly going to students and their learning, but to go to more centralized district and school matters that are not directly focused on each and every student and how kids are educated. So the comprehensive nature, the large regional high school nature of schools started out with good intent. And there was good argument to keep schools small. It was just the economy of scale argument that kept schools larger and made them too large, and it got blown out. So what we have to do now is figure out how to develop a place where students feel good, are learning, feel safe, parents feel that they're safe, and that they know are known well by adults who are their teachers and people in the community who they share interests with. One more point. In our urban schools, we have between 40, 50, and 60% dropout rates. If we talked about cost per graduate, and I wouldn't necessarily only talk about big picture schools, I would talk about small schools, good small schools who are really operating as democratic schools, who are operating to let parents in and get engage families. If you talk about cost per graduate instead of cost per student, all of a sudden you're doing a whole heck of a lot better economically than schools that are losing 50% of their population. Right now, collectively, our attendance at all of our schools is way above 90%, probably 92, 93%. We've had 5 graduating classes in Providence, and all of our students, 98% have been accepted to college, and we have a 4% dropout rate. Now, can we scale it is the question. Scaling in what sense? Well, we don't want to scale and have thousands of schools. We don't have any kind of capacity to do that. But we get calls every day, every other day, about how to help support and influence people who are starting small schools. Also, how we maintain and sustain high-quality small schools that we're always working on, because it's always hard to start something up, especially when a system is not set up to deal with smallness, but is set up to deal with the large comprehensive nature of schools that can have negative impact. So there's a lot of work to be done around scale. It's a very in-depth, layered conversation. It's not an easy thing to do to scale anything. Certainly it's not an easy thing to grow and start up small schools. Better policy pieces would also help a lot.
What are those policy pieces?
Well, policy pieces that organize schools around cost per pupil for small schools instead of large comprehensive, which looks differently. Direct support of funding to the students, more teachers dealing with less students. Teacher training programs at our colleges and universities that focus in on being a teacher in a small school, being a principal in a small school. So the training is done in undergraduate work to some degree. I would even suggest that the first couple of years of school, there would be internships for new teachers and new principals. That's what they do in medical school and with residencies, and it seemed to work. I think that the same kind of policies need to be in place in our own general educational public system. Those are a couple. Building small schools facilities is another one. Building community schools that are open all the time, with shared use with other departments and cities using the schools, joint ventures with human service organizations, food and nutrition, health and housing. Those are all factors that play into whether or not students are learning in a kind of way where we're not having to worry about whether somebody is sick or somebody in somebody's family is not healthy. And those things do get in the way and can. And the more supports we have in schools dealing with those other issues, because outside comes inside a school. And many schools, unfortunately, that are large, the issues are not known by each and every teacher. Maybe if they have a younger brother and sister that they have to take care of. Maybe somebody got sick in their family or lost their job. There's all kinds of things that happen. And what happens is if you lose a few days or a week, and you get behind, all of a sudden you get too far behind and you drop out. And you may be dropping out needlessly. If the system knew what was going on and could address your needs in a more highly personalized manner.
What is your toughest challenge in expanding big picture schools?
Well, our toughest challenge is not really with expansion. Our toughest challenge is maintaining the quality, starting up well, and sustaining them. We want to see our schools around for a long time. So all those things are real, real important. Having good community facilities are real, real important to the sustainability aspect. Having highly qualified people that we can find, and that may be look different than sometimes what they're certified in, because it's more than just being certified. You can have certified and not qualified. So we're talking about highly qualified teachers in our schools with our students. Those are real, real important things. Great principal leaders, as well as cities and mayors' offices and superintendents who truly understand the nature of learning and the innovation of the work that we're trying to do, as well as following our students out after they graduate high school. Socioeconomic minority students, 100% entering college, 10% are graduating. So we have to change those odds. We can send a whole lot of students to college, and they accrue high loans and not a piece of paper at the end of their stay in college and leave. And that's not good enough. So supports have to be in place to make sure that each and every one of our students is successful in college and then productive as citizens.
Thanks so much for being our guest.
Take care now.
Elliot Washer co-directs The Big Picture Company. After a short break, we'll return to talk to Otis White about lowering the cost of elections in San Diego. And in the second half of our show, we'll talk with Matt Fellows about unfair prices in one American inner city. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Otis White runs Civic Strategies in Atlanta, and each week he brings us urban insights from around the country. Otis, you found a story about a new approach to elections in San Diego.
Yeah, you know, democracy isn't free, as everybody reminds us. And in fact, in San Diego, it costs between $2 million and $3 million to put on election, almost any election. And San Diego is really, really strapped for money these days for a whole lot of reasons. And they've got a special election coming up for the mayor's office. And for a while, they were looking at the possibility of, this sounds very strange, of holding a completely mailed-in election. That is, they would not open the precincts. Everybody would be treated like an absentee voter. They thought that if they could do that, they could save about half the cost of the election. Now, in the end, they decided not to do it for a lot of political reasons, one of which is people are pretty cynical there, and they thought that anything that's done differently would only increase the cynicism in San Diego. But they did go a long way in looking at how to do one of these things. And first of all, it is legal in California to hold completely mailed-in elections. They can't do it if there's a state office on the ballot or a federal office, but if it's a purely local one, they can do it. And they have hospital and water district elections that are held by mail only in California. So the way it would work is this. You would get, every voter would get a ballot mailed to him or her. It would have little ovals, these are optical scan ballots, and you have little ovals next to the candidates' names, and you'd shade it in. And then you fold it up and put it in the approved envelope with barcodes that are on the envelope that are linked to your signature, which are in a computer file. You'd sign the envelope. You'd mail it in. And the first thing they do at the voter office is run it through that bar scanner, the envelope, that is. They'd look at your signature on the computer screen, look at the signature on the ballot, and if the two matched, that's a valid ballot. And then they'd open the envelope and run it through the scanner, and you would have voted. And they actually think that if they could do this, it would increase the turnout for elections. But they decided in the end not to do it. But it's always out there as an option.
I think it's a terrific innovation, although I have to admit I think I would miss both the neighborliness of voting at my local poll and also the conviviality, I guess, of working a poll for a candidate, which I normally do because it's retail politics that it's most interesting.
Well, you just have to go to their house to find them then,
Carol. Yeah, well, that's a lot more time-consuming. I've done that, too. We'll talk to you next week, Otis.
Thanks, Carol.
You're listening to Smart City. Matt Fellows is Senior Research Associate at Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program. His work focuses primarily on issues related to low-income working families. He is principal author of the report, The Price is Wrong, Getting the Market Right for Working Families in Philadelphia. Matt is an adjunct professor of public policy at Georgetown University and George Washington University. Matt, we often talk about the ladder of opportunity in America that allows people who are poor to climb their way into the middle class. But in Philadelphia, you found solid evidence of a barrier to getting out of poverty, the high price of goods and services in low-income neighborhoods. Tell me what you found.
We, over the course of the last year, my colleague Bruce Katz and I, measured the costs of 13 major necessities that every family depends on, from auto insurance to auto loans to the cost of gasoline to the cost of financial services to the cost of mortgages, even furniture and appliances. And what we found is that across the board, low-income working families pay higher prices than higher-income households. So for nearly every basic necessity, aside from the cost of their house, poor families can pay hundreds of dollars every year in higher prices for basic necessities. And this was, I think, known already by these families, and it's known by some people that are working on behalf of these families. But what's less recognized is the fact that these higher prices are literally across the board for almost every basic necessity. And it adds up to a major roadblock for these working families trying to get ahead, because what it means is that income supports like the earned income tax credit or food stamps or market reforms like minimum wage laws, for instance, some of those reforms actually don't add up to the difference that they might otherwise because of the fact that that extra income is being chewed up by these extra costs for working families.
Matt, describe the scope of the problem. How much difference are we talking about? Perhaps you can take one of those 13 categories and give me an example.
Sure. Most people are familiar with how this works in the mortgage market. We used a national sample collected by the Federal Reserve. It's the Survey of Consumer Finances. And what we found is that over 50% of households earning less than $30,000 were charged a higher interest rate among all households in this survey, but less than a quarter of households earning more than $100,000 paid an above-average interest rate. Some other evidence. We looked at 650,000 car purchases and found that the typical low-income household that earns less than $20,000 will pay $500 more for the exact same car that's bought by a household earning more than $70,000. For car insurance, we looked at what the cost of insuring a $5,100 car, which happened to be a Ford Taurus, about 4 years old. We looked at what the cost of insuring that car would be for a household earning less than $30,000 and compared that to households earning more than $70,000. And what we found is that low-income households will pay about $400 more every year to insure that exact same car than if a higher-income household insured that car. And it's important to point out that not all of these higher costs are because of pernicious businesses out there that are taking advantage of low-income households. Well, that's certainly an element of this. Part of the story is also that businesses face real higher risk when they sell many goods and services to low-income families, and they have to charge higher prices to compensate for those higher risks. So, for instance, low-income households are much more likely to default on loans. This lowers their credit scores, which raises the prices they pay for insurance, for financial services, even for utility security deposits. They're also more likely to live in neighborhoods with above-average crime rates, which raises, in some cases, the cost of doing businesses in those neighborhoods. So these higher costs of doing business are then passed on to low-income consumers through higher prices. It also has to do with market information not being as available in the homes of low-income families. So one of the best sources today for getting information about the marketplace is the internet. And low-income households, as a group, have much less access to those types of information resources. But it's also financial education as an explanation for why low-income households lack as much information as higher-income households, because many public schools don't offer the financial education curriculum that they used to offer. And because of this, new market phenomena like credit scores, for instance, which influence the price of insurance and financial services and utility security deposits, is just not known by a lot of low-income households.
Were you able to add up the impact for the individual household on these price differences that they're experiencing?
That would have been the ideal if we could have done that. But unfortunately, every household consumes differently. We can point to things like cars, and we can point to things like insurance and food and furniture and appliances, and we know that all households consume these necessities. But what we can't tell you is what type of each of these necessities these households consume. So what we did is we looked at sort of a constant basic measure across these different types of necessities, of individual types of necessities. So, for instance, with the car, we looked at what the average value of a car among the bottom income quintile in the United States, and that was about $5,100. So we then looked at what car sort of approximated that value, and it was a Ford Taurus, and then we collected prices associated with that particular car. So this is more of a illustration of these price discriminations than it is an exact accounting of how much this all adds up to for a particular economy. Now, that's not to say I didn't try to do that, but at the end of the day, we just weren't happy enough with our ability to fully capture what different households consume.
Now, you found that these high prices have not only an effect on the individual and the household, but also on the city, and you looked at the effects on the city of Philadelphia.
So the city of Philadelphia has done just a remarkable job over the last few years in addressing some of these higher costs. It's part of the reason why we picked Philadelphia, because we wanted to illustrate for other cities sort of what Philadelphia has been doing. But it does have effects in the city, and you can see these effects. I mean, the bankruptcy rate has increased every year for the past 5 years. The foreclosure rate has gone up, spurring the banking secretary to announce a number of new initiatives that's attempting to sort of curb the market abuses that are going on in that industry. But you can also see it in the neighborhoods. There's just Bruce and I, in an op-ed that we published in the Philadelphia Inquirer, referred to this as sort of the two economies in Philadelphia. And you can really see those two economies in these different neighborhoods, where a low-income neighborhood might have a 5,000 square foot on average grocery store or convenience store. A higher-income neighborhood will have a 25 or 30,000 square foot grocery store, and that translates into very different prices. You also see it in where institutions like check cashers and payday lenders are located in rent-owned stores. So you can see very clear differences in the retail establishments across these different neighborhoods. And what that adds up to is an economy in Philadelphia for low-income families that keeps these families poor. It starts with businesses assessing higher risks for low-income families, then charging higher prices to compensate for those higher risks. And that means that the consumers in the market with the least amount of money end up being charged the highest prices for basic necessities. That in turn creates real risk because their delinquencies and default go up, which then translates into higher prices. So it's the cycle effect. And for cities like Philadelphia, that means that no matter how much they succeed at creating income supports or work supports for families or economies which create jobs for low-income families, there's still that economy at the end of the day where low-income families are spending money, which is keeping those families poor. And so that means that the city loses potentially quite a bit of money for programs.
You're listening to Smart City. Our guest is Matt Fellows. He is Senior Research Associate with Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program and principal author of the report, The Price is Wrong, Getting the Market Right for Working Families in Philadelphia. Is there anything that can be done to lower the risk. I mean, you said that's a reasonable explanation, one of the explanations for the higher prices. Can risk be lowered?
It can, and this, I think, is one of the promises of shifting the emphasis from the income side of a family's budget to the expense side, because on that expense side, you significantly expand both the types of policies but also the number of actors that can be invested in these anti-poverty efforts. So let me give you an example. In Philadelphia, over the last year, the city has raised $30 million from private sources, $10 million from the state government. That's going to be used to attract supermarkets back into Philadelphia's low-income neighborhoods. So what that's doing then is it's acknowledging the higher costs of doing business in these neighborhoods or the more uncertain market demand in those neighborhoods, and it's going to pay these companies essentially front-end costs associated with developing supermarkets in those neighborhoods. So businesses are benefiting then from these resources that are being collected for them, but low-income families are also stand to benefit because they're going to be shopping at larger grocery stores and not having to get into the car or public transportation and go out to different neighborhoods with larger grocery stores. So that's one example. Through subsidizing these higher costs of doing business directly, leaders can lower prices for low-income families. Another way is by pooling the costs of doing business. This is probably best evidenced in the insurance market in states like Massachusetts. So Massachusetts requires insurance companies to heavily cross-subsidize different insurance risks. And what that means is that high-risk drivers, which for a variety of reasons tend to be low-income households, at least they're much more likely to be assigned that higher risk, it requires companies to spread out that higher risk among low-risk drivers. And so what you have is a redistribution of risk, and the effect is that the price of insurance is much more equal across the market. Another way, and this is probably the most promising and the least well recognized, is that leaders need, and I think they are increasingly, looking at how the risks of doing business or the costs of doing business are measured. So over the past 5 months, five states have sponsored legislation that would ban the ability of insurance companies to use credit scores in the calculation of insurance rates. And that's important because credit scores are generally lower for lower-income households, which means they're automatically charged this higher rate for insurance. Another example of how risks of doing business or costs of doing business are being assessed more closely is through the number of studies that have looked at the unmet market demand in these low-income neighborhoods because of the data and the data quality in particular that is fueling the decisions about where businesses are located in urban economies. But there's also opportunities for reducing market abuses and boosting information. And in fact, I think reducing market abuses has probably got the most attention because it's such a clear example of egregious behavior in the marketplace.
Give me an example of what you mean.
There's been legislation over the last 5 years sponsored in 33 states that would curb market abuses in the mortgage industry. And so this would ban practices like prepayment penalties, kickbacks to brokers through yield spread premiums. And some of this legislation is being passed in states like South Carolina by Republicans. So this is an opportunity, I think, to curb abuses across party lines. There's also efforts underway to curb payday lending. These are typically two-week loans that have, at least nationally, an average APR 450%. To most households, 90% of households over $70,000 anyway, use a credit card for those types of loans. But low-income households have much less access to credit cards, so they rely on payday loans. And there's basically very little regulation that's out there that's curbing the fees. But it's not just policy that's lowering these market abuses. There's also market innovation. And I think this is one of the most exciting areas when it comes to market abuses because this type of reform doesn't depend on political cycles. It also doesn't depend on government expenditures. This is organic market activity that's lowering the cost the abuses in the market. So, for instance, in the remittance market, which annually charges billions of dollars in fees every year, predominantly to the low-income immigrants that are sending money back to their countries of origin, a number of mainstream financial institutions have recognized that there's a substantial amount of money available in those markets. and that has increased competition in the remittance market considerably over the last 5 years. And the Pew Hispanic Center recently came out a report that suggested that increased competition has already lowered prices in the remittance market by 50%. Another example of market innovation are these free tax preparation firms that have popped up around the country and organizations. I mean, there's literally hundreds of these organizations now that provide free tax preparation, and many of them are targeted towards low-income households. And that's challenging the market share of for-profit tax preparation institutions, which can charge low-income households hundreds of dollars. There's also alternative loan products being developed. In Philadelphia, Citizens Bank has worked with the Greater Philadelphia Urban Affairs Coalition in the city to create two loan products for low-income households called the Phil Plus and the Mini Phil, which are low-cost loan products for home renovation. So through a number of different ways, then, market abuses are being curbed, which are translating into lower prices for low-income families.
Did you consider the option, Matt, of lowering prices to low-income families by making public some of the things they spend their money on, for instance, transportation? So a better public transit system, for instance, not only lowers the cost by eliminating the need for an automobile, as an example, and the insurance that goes along with it, and the licenses and fees that go along with it. Plus, it helps not simply low-income people, but people of all incomes. Therefore, it's more likely to be supported. I mean, did you look at those kinds of solutions?
Yeah. I mean, certainly in Pennsylvania, an example of that type of reform that brings broad benefits to a city is the financial education reform, because that financial education curriculum is being planned for public schools throughout Philadelphia, and they're in the process of working out exactly what that curriculum will look like. But absolutely, I think that's absolutely key to some of these reforms that happen on the policy side, are justifying them by the fact that they provide these broad benefits to all families. I mean, financial education, I think, is just absolutely a key part of this puzzle. Credit scores have sort of popped up all over the place in these markets of necessities, and I think very few people understand exactly what they are or what factors go into the calculation of credit scores. So that's the financial education curriculum that can create that information for consumers will yield broad benefits.
Do you think we've tried to push too many people into home ownership?
That is an excellent question, and I think that is going to be the center of a big debate over the next few years. Home ownership is a key part of the ownership society, which is a big part of the Bush administration's efforts to help low-income families just by expanding home ownership or asset attainment. Certainly, since the early 90s, home ownership has been soaring for all income groups except for the very poor in America. But at the same time, foreclosures and bankruptcies have been also escalating. And at the same time, less well recognized is the propensity of loans to become delinquent. So I do think that home ownership has, for a long time, sort of been a major aspiration for advocates for the poor, because it is an intelligent investment, because it's an asset that builds wealth for low-income families. But I don't think there's been enough attention to the way that that asset's being created for low-income families. The subprime market is just soaring in this country, and some studies suggest that 50% of the subprime borrowers actually qualify for a prime loan. It's not clear yet in my mind whether it's that low-income households that are homeowners, which are becoming delinquent and falling into bankruptcies or foreclosing on their homes, whether that's being caused by the fact that they're just not good homeowners, or that they've been charged egregious rates, or they haven't been given proper financial education. So I think this is going to be a real central challenge going forward as we think about homeownership in low-income households.
Have you considered, Matt, the impact that your move toward providing more competitive options like the bigger supermarket versus the corner grocery store? Maybe you get lower prices, but you also get abandonment in the neighborhood of those corner grocery stores. So there's an offset there. There's an unintended consequence. What do you think about that problem that you're perhaps creating?
Well, I think most policy alternatives have benefits and costs, and certainly that's a cost that's significant. Though, I think it's important to point out that a lot of these corner grocery stores are not sort of your paragon of good small business owners. A lot of these companies end up just price gouging because there's no competition in these neighborhoods, and so they can charge higher prices than they would if there's competition. I should point out that with the specific example of supermarkets, that in Philadelphia, they're trying over the course of this year to expand the number of supermarkets in the city by 20. Many of the people that are qualifying for these loan guarantees and planning supports are actually medium-sized businesses, most of them local or regional.
Do you sense that since the publication of your report, there has been forward movement in Philadelphia on your recommendations?
There has, and I think that's been evidenced in several ways. I mean, first, when Bruce and I originally were talking about this report a couple months ago about sort of what we wanted out of this, out of the first year following the publication, was really a sort of a change in the debate, in the terms of the debate. So moving the debate from just a debate that was focused on the income side of a family's budget to the expense side. And I think that that transition is certainly evidenced by the fact that there's been quite a bit of media attention in Philadelphia. I mean, between the two papers, there's been nearly a dozen stories. There's also been a lot of radio attention. On the policy side, those are sort of longer range alternatives. But there's already, in just 2 months, I think, been evidence that the debate has started to change or at least expand in Philadelphia, and at the same time, there's been a political response. There's also talk about having follow-up hearings in Philadelphia a year from now to assess the amount of legislation that's been passed or the amount of reform that's taken place. So I think then, through a number of ways, it's had an effect. But the test will be a year from now.
Thanks for being our guest on Smart City.
My pleasure.
Matt Fellows is Senior Research Associate at Brookings Institution's Metropolitan Policy Program and principal author of the report, The Price is Wrong. You're listening to Smart City. You're listening to Smart City. I'm Carol Coletta. Being poor is expensive, and it doesn't make you any happier as a person, but City View's commentator Walker Smith says there's no emotional fulfillment in having too much either.
The paradox of superabundance is that in the midst of more social and personal prosperity than ever before, we are no happier. This puzzle was examined in detail by emeritus Yale University political scientist Robert Lane in his Turn of the Millennium synthesis, The Loss of Happiness in Market Democracies. Notwithstanding rising indicators of social and material well-being like GDP, equality for women, old age pensions, a free press, democratic institutions, greater education, and more access to media and information, survey measures of self-reported happiness have been declining for decades. Additionally, depression and teen suicides are up. The old saw is true. Money can't buy happiness. This is not to say that people in abject poverty are the happiest people of all. More money does bring more happiness, but only up to a point. That threshold was calculated from the World Values Survey of 1990-91 by University of Michigan political scientist Ronald Engelhardt. He found it to be equal to the per capita GNP of Ireland in 1990. Above that level of prosperity, there is no correlation between the average wealth of a country and its average level of happiness. There are many reasons why money and happiness are unrelated. Lane concludes that the primary reason for the declining levels of happiness in more prosperous societies is that the pursuit of prosperity takes time away from personal relationships. Yet it's relationships with others that make us happy. Making money estranges us from one another, leaving us less happy, even depressed. Structural elements and other characteristics of the consumer economy also play a part. Various researchers have cited things like too many choices, an overemphasis on instant gratification and selfish interest, the over-arousal of appetites, spiraling levels of expectations, more stress, less free time, too much focus on the future and too little on the here and now, worries about debt, and the unrelenting pressure to buy. Indeed, it is difficult to envision a market-driven society in which people are perfectly content because the engine of market growth is consumer demand. Marketing plays the central role in stimulating consumer demand by motivating people to want something different or something more than what they have right now. A certain degree of dissatisfaction, if not unhappiness, is essential. But in a marketplace of superabundance and luxury expectations, the ever greater time and energy spent on acquisitiveness leaves us with an even more acutely felt need for happiness. True meaning and fulfillment can only be found outside the marketplace. Indeed, even as the marketplace and its metaphors have become more central to our lifestyles, there is a more widespread and deeper feeling that notwithstanding all we've accumulated and attained, something vital is still missing. This is the new frontier of relevance and satisfaction, a new paradox of abundance. A world in which the marketplace provides as much as ever, but in which more than ever we are looking beyond it. The salience and importance of non-material things are on the rise. This entails new demands and new priorities, but it promises a new contentment as well. For City Views, this is Walker Smith.
Walker Smith is president of Yankelovich Partners. He comes to us from Georgia Public Radio in Atlanta. Join us online at smartcityradio.com to hear Smart City Broadcast, sign up for our podcast, listen to archive shows, and register for our weekly newsletter with information about our guest. Thanks to Charles Edwards at Georgia Public Radio for his production assistance. Jeffrey Reddick edits Smart City. Our theme music was created and performed by Robbie Grant and Steve Selvage. Smart City is a production of WKNO in Memphis. I'm Carol Coletta.